Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Olympic Games in London that opened Friday and speak with Francis Wheen, the deputy editor of Britain's satirical magazine Private Eye, to get a sense of the unintended comedy of errors that has accompanied Mitt Romney's arrival in London. Before meeting the British Prime Minister, Mitt managed to offend him, prompting a rebuke from David Cameron, who, in a snide reference to Salt Lake City, snapped that putting on the Olympics in London is not the same as holding the Olympic Games in the middle of nowhere. And then we will speak with economist Justin Wolfers, a visiting professor at Princeton and professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity. We will discuss his article at Bloomberg, "The U.S. Economic Policy Debate is a Sham." Then finally, we will speak with author and conservationist William Dubuis, the author of A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the American Southwest. We will discuss the lethal combination of heat, droughts and insect plagues, windstorms and forest fires that will become the new norm in the American West. And joining us now from London is Francis Wheen, who is a journalist, broadcaster and writer. He is the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, and he's written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francis Wheen.
Welcome to you, too.
And we have just exported to the United Kingdom on the eve of the London Olympics the Republican nominee for president, Mitt Romney, who apparently has already managed to put his foot in it. He apparently told an American broadcaster before meeting with the Prime Minister he was quite critical of the way the London Olympics are being handled. And a rather peeved Cameron soon rebuked Romney, saying, quoting, "We are holding an Olympics Games in one of the busiest, most active, bustling cities anywhere in the world. Of course, it's easier to if you hold an Olympic Games in the middle of nowhere," which I guess was a barb at Romney and Salt Lake City.
I think you can safely assume that, yeah. Well, it is amazing because our mayor in London, Boris Johnson, is a bit of a chump, as we might say over here. He's sort of character out of P.G. Woodhouse, who's always putting his foot in it and making a fool of himself and behaving like Bertie Wooster. But actually, Romney has achieved the rare feat by coming over here of making Boris look like Demosthenes. I mean, I've never seen anyone so clumsy and stupid and accident-prone. He got so many things wrong. He's only been here for a short while so far. But already he blurted out that he'd had a private briefing session with the head of MI6, you know, the guy who's called M in the James Bond films. And by and large, foreign opposition leaders or opposition candidates don't usually get that sort of thing. And you're certainly not meant to mention it if you do. It's, you know, a sort of code of secrecy about these things. And said he'd been briefed on Syria and 101 other things. So that embarrassed MI6. He then annoyed David Cameron by suggesting before he came on his NBC interview that it all looked a bit iffy, a bit disastrous in the making, and so then got his justified rebuke saying, well, all you've ever done is organise the Winter Olympics in the middle of nowhere. He had a meeting with the Labour Party leader, Ed Miliband, and called him Mr. Leader throughout, presumably because he'd forgotten his name, which is forgivable, but it did make it sound a bit like a trip to North Korea, you know, the great leader and the dear leader and Mr. Leader, the rather junior person. And actually, it feels a bit like North Korea at the moment in London, because Tony Blair, one of the last things he bequeathed us before he scarpered, was to pass an act in 2006, a law, called the Olympics and the Paralympics Act 2006, which gives incredible powers to the International Olympic Committee and orders the police to enforce them. So, for example, to protect the sponsors, you're not allowed, if you're not an official sponsor like Visa or Coca-Cola or McDonald's, to use, under this act, use words like Olympics and 2012 or Olympics and London, or even Olympics and summer in the same phrase. And there are bakers who've been putting up little round donuts in their window in the shape of the five Olympic rings because they thought it would make a nice window display in little villages. And they found the police raiding them and saying you're going to be prosecuted if you don't take that down at once. And it is, I mean, even little cakes, you know, if amateur bakers make a cake and decorate it with the Olympic symbol and put it up for sale at the village fete, they'll then get the police descending on them to protect the rights of the International Olympic Committee. And they've got lanes all over London in the main roads marked with the rings, which are now like Zill lanes in the old Soviet Union, where members of the Politburo can go, but nobody else can. And I was in London quite a lot last week, and I even drove in one of these lanes just before the rules came into force, just for the hell of it, just for the fun of driving in a Zill lane. But it is a bit creepy.
So is there any substance to the criticism that came from Romney about the London being ill-prepared and the security not being up to snuff, etc.?
Well, that's the slightly annoying thing, that he was actually right. I hate to say it, Mitt Romney, but he was right the first time and wrong the second time. Because I expect it'll pass off all right, but it has been a disaster, the run-up to it. The security was given over to a firm called G4S, which used to be called Group 4 and then merged with Securicorps, which had a reputation when it was called Group 4 for doing privatized work guarding prisoners and kept letting them escape by mistake. They were meant to be taking charge of all the security of the Olympics, and only about 2 weeks ago they had to own up to the government that they hadn't recruited nearly enough people and they'd sort of somehow forgotten to get round to it. So the British Army is now going to have to do it, and the police, because they made a hash of it. So Romney's quite right. I mean, it's been a fiasco. And actually, the fiascos continue. Only last night, even before the opening ceremony, there was a football game, a soccer game, between North Korea and somebody. And on the big screens at the start of the game, they showed the South Korean flag beside the members of the North Korean team. So the North Korean footballers all walked off in protest, and it took an hour to get them back on the pitch with lots of apologies and things. And I heard one of the spokespeople for the London Olympic Committee saying, it was human error, it won't happen again. And you thought, well, human error does happen again. That's what human error means. You can't predict or when it's going to strike. So I dare say there will be other cock-ups of that sort. So Romney's sort of broadly right, but it's just a bit rich coming from him. We don't like taking lectures from a man who wears magic underpants, frankly.
Well, you know, there's been quite a controversy here in the United States about the fact that the Olympic uniforms were manufactured in China under the brand of Ralph Lauren, and that has created a kind of patriotic backlash. But apparently Mitt Romney did even better when he was doing the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. He managed to have the Olympic uniforms manufactured in Burma.
Bless him. Occasionally one tries to console oneself by thinking, this man is so clumsy and so obviously all over the place that surely, to goodness, he can't be elected. But then you think of other people of that sort who have been elected in the past, and it's not quite so funny anymore. But yes, I think that's probably the case. And certainly oppressive regimes. Part of the problem, I suspect, is that the last Olympics 4 years ago were in Beijing. And, of course, the Chinese authorities could do whatever they liked. You know, they could move a million people out of the way or do whatever they wanted to achieve their ambitions and put on a great show. Whereas over here we're supposed to be a liberal democracy and we don't take so kindly to that sort of oppressiveness. And so, I mean, Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, and Sebastian Coe, the head of the London Olympic organisers, in the last 2 or 3 days have been going around saying, stop moaning, stop whinging, get behind the project. You think, well, actually, moaning and whinging and complaining, that's one of the very few things in which we lead the world, and they're telling us that we shouldn't do it. I mean, this is one of the few sports at which we would undoubtedly win a gold medal, and I think it's one of our saving graces that we're not that impressed by strutting totalitarian figures who come round bossing us about. But anyway, they're telling us we've got to get behind it and stop moaning. But luckily, I mean, of course, you know, I'm sure the opening ceremony on Friday will be all the word is that it's going to be rather good. And I'm sure, you know, the swimmers and the pole vaulters and the javelin throwers will all be terrifically good. But it's the rest of it, the backdrop to it, the awful authoritarian regime imposed on this country by the International Olympic Committee. I mean, in 2005, when we won the Games, and London won the Games, it was said that, you know, Britain has won the Olympics, and actually the Olympics won Britain. They have, you know, for the next 2 weeks, they will be actually running large parts of the country and have full powers of arrest.
Well, there's an assumption that the opening ceremonies will be, you know, majestic, and the punditry over here is chattering about how only the British put on such great pageantry, whether it's a coronation or a royal wedding or a funeral, they excel. So there's an expectation that this is going to be like, you know, Princess Di's wedding or something.
Well, I hope it's not pageantry, because although I suppose we do that sort of thing reasonably well, we've had hundreds of years to practice things like the coronation and the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. You know, that's quite easy. You just get the household cavalry out and they ride up and down the Mall in their fancy uniforms and golden carriages wafted down to Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's Cathedral or whatever. You know, we can do that sort of thing, but I think it'd be awful if it was like that. It'd be vainglorious, imperialistic, and generally nauseating to many people in this country. I think what we'd like to see, especially the more we're told to stop moaning, is some recognition in the opening ceremony that one of the few things we have left, having lost our empire and crashed our economy, is a sort of slightly grumpy sense of humour. And I would quite like there to be an element of that in it, a bit of mischief and a bit of humour, rather than just lots of people in fancy uniforms parading around.
Again, I'm speaking with Francis Wheen, who is in London. He's a journalist, broadcaster and writer, and the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye. He has written a number of books, including Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. And we're talking about the Olympic Games in London opening on Friday. And, of course, I mentioned at the beginning that we've exported Mitt Romney, the hapless candidate, who, by the way, may well be elected president of the United States. You know, the Republicans have made a very wise investment in ignorance in this country. And
they didn't have much choice, given what else was available in the primaries. You know, you sort of felt that, you know, would they have done any better with some of the other candidates who were storming through the primaries? And so probably they made the right choice in Mitt Romney, and he's just got to keep very quiet about Mormonism between now and November, and he's got to try and remember quite how right-wing or not very right-wing he is, according to which audience he's addressing, and what precisely he's said in the past, except, of course, he can't escape that because it all comes out, thanks to the wonders of YouTube and things like that. I mean, the moment he flip-flops, it's all out there. You know, never mind John Stewart. It's all over the internet.
Well, he's also got a slight problem with not wanting to release any tax returns because...
Oh, I know. Isn't that great? But partly because he's such a patriotic American that he feels obliged to put all his money somewhere else.
and apparently he's not going to release it. And so that obviously will be a water torture, drip, drip, drip. But again, I'm not sure that the people of this country, you know, they may well think that, we have this game show democracy. We can make a choice. Let's make a choice.
So are you now saying it's up to us, the Brits, to try and sabotage Romney before he comes back to America, make him completely unelectable by making him even more of a fool, catching him out?
From your lips to God's ears, I say. But I wanted to mention your export to us.
No, not Piers Morgan, I hope.
Exactly. How did you know? That's the very person I wanted to talk about, because
I thought it could only be Simon Cowell or Piers Morgan, and I put a small bet on Piers Morgan.
No, well, I must say, this anxious toady...
He's in London for the Olympics, so you're free of him for a week or so.
No, but he's just done an interview with Mitt and Ann Romney, and it is the most unctuous drivel, the most pathetic pandering that clearly this guy wants to be hired by the Romney team as the next press secretary.
Well, I know. Piers is very good at that. I mean, as John Reed said of the Russian Revolution, I have seen the future and it smirks. Actually, he didn't quite say that, but that's the case with Piers Morgan. Talk about making a little go a long way. I mean, I've known Piers since he was a junior reporter on the Sun newspaper in London, making a fool of himself, doing the showbiz column and the rock column. And he was only hard because the editor thought it'd be a joke having this posh, gormless character. He was called Piers Pugh Morgan in those days, had a double-barrel name, hanging out with all these rock stars. But Piers made a terrific job of it, did a deal with all the stars he interviewed, saying, look, if you will be photographed with me and pretend you're my friend, I will give you a fantastic write-up. And so day after day, there'd be peers with not just rock stars, film stars, you know, there'd be peers with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone at the opening of the Hard Rock Cafe saying, my mates, Sly and Arnie. Peers with, I don't know, Bruce Springsteen or whoever it might be. He then disgraced himself as editor of the Daily Mirror twice over and was eventually sacked in utter disgrace. And we thought, well, that's the end of Piers. And as so often happens with our discards, someone in America picked him up, unbelievably. It's very odd. I mean, the last editor of the News of the World is now a newspaper editor in New York. I don't know what's the matter with you.
Well, he seems to have dodged this bullet vis-a-vis the phone hacking, this embroiled News Corp.
Yes. Well, Piers, it may yet happen that Piers has to come back and answer a few questions from Scotland Yard about all this, because there is now increasing investigation into what happened at the Mirror when he was editor, the police have said that they are worried about certain things. And Piers himself, I mean, he used to boast about it famously with Paul McCartney. One of Piers' party tricks was to say to people at dinner or in the bar, oh, I've heard Paul McCartney's messages that he left on Heather Mills' answering machine after they had a row and he was winning her back by singing, we can work it out. And at the time, Piers obviously thought this was a harmless little anecdote to tell in the pub. But now, with all the phone hacking stuff, it's rather come back to bite him.
So, Francis Wheen, just to go back to Mitt Romney, and, you know, I do hope you keep us posted on his next gaffes, which will surely come.
Well, we'll try and provoke a few, I hope.
That's even better.
I think that's the only service we can now do to our former colonies, is to try and save them from Mitt Romney.
Well, apparently one of his aides, before they left, told the Daily Telegraph that Mitt Romney, in a none-too-veiled reference to our African-American president, saying that unlike our president, Romney represents and values the Anglo-Saxon bonds.
Oh, yes, I heard that. Yeah. It wasn't really very coded, was it? Given that... Well, actually, Mitt Romney is, I suppose, a little bit Anglo-Saxon on his mother's side. But even so, I mean, the way it was phrased, there could only be one interpretation of what he was trying to say. You don't really need a dog whistle for canines to understand that message, I think.
Well, our unctuous Piers in his interview on CNN said that... pointed out that Miles Romney, his great-grandfather, was more English than Piers was because he grew up in Ireland. So more of the grovelling.
Piers claimed he grew up in Ireland. That's completely untrue. Complete codswallop. He grew up in Sussex.
Right. Well,
it's not the first time Piers has some... had a slightly loose acquaintance with the truth, I'm afraid, but there we are.
I thank you for joining us. I imagine we'll all be watching on the openings, and I do hope...
Well, that'll all be quite good, I imagine. Yeah. And, I'm sure Usain Bolt will be, very watchable, and all those people will be watchable. It's just, you should think yourself lucky you're not actually in London for it, because the chaos, I can't begin to tell you. I mean, on Monday I was getting a train out of London back to East Anglia, to Essex. And the first stop is Stratford, which is the HQ of the Olympics. It's where the stadium is, where the Olympic Village is, where everything else is. It's the Olympic station, as it were. And we crawled out of London towards Stratford, and eventually the voice came over and said, I'm very sorry for this today. All sorts of things have gone wrong at Stratford, the signals, the points, the this, that, and the other. A lot of trains have been cancelled altogether. And we spent about an hour creeping through at a snail's pace. And part of that time, we were sort of just outside Stratford Station, looking across through the windows at the Olympic Stadium, the ludicrous Anish Kapoor sculpture, all sorts of other stuff. And there we were, stranded in baking heat in this airless train carriage. And I was thinking, I do hope the likes of Mitt Romney are advised to take public transport. Then they'll rarely suffer.
Well, I hope the patrician learns how the plebeians live, but I think that's asking for too much from Mitt.
I'm very worried on your behalf now. If there's anything else we can do,
I'll let you know.
I do feel actually that I know because of the, you know, the long and distinguished tradition in America of separation of religion and state and all the rest of it, freedom of religion and freedom from religion, that it's sort of thought to be bad form to mention anyone's religion. But it does seem to me that the Mormon business, that at some point someone ought to bring it up. I mean, you know, how far does this go? You know, if Tom Cruise ran for president, would no one mention Scientology? It has to be vaguely relevant, doesn't it?
Well, it's that's one of the great amusements of American politics. The two most important things in our lives, politics and religion, are not suitable for public discussion. So,
well, anyway, he's achieved a great thing because David Cameron, who's a Conservative Prime Minister, and Boris Johnson, who's Conservative Mayor of London, and so you think natural allies of the Republican candidate, are both now completely fed up with him and rubbishing him and being very rude about him in a way. He's not really winning round the right beyond America much, as far as I can see.
Well, we see how he does in Poland and in Israel. And I thank you very much for joining us, Francis Wheen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Francis Wheen, who is a journalist, broadcaster, and writer. He is the deputy editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, and he's written for a variety of publications and regularly appears on such BBC's programs as The News Quiz. His books include the award-winning biography Karl Marx, A Life, Idiot Proof, A Short History of Modern Delusions, and Strange Days Indeed, The Golden Age of Paranoia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an economist about how the national debate about the economy is a sham. What if I stumble? What if I fall? What if I lose my step and I make fools of us all? Will the love continue when my walk becomes a crawl? What if I stumble? And what if I...
They are having a blast while they're working poor, trying to make a paycheck last. The bailout money is created with new debt while they're rolling in the nimble as private jets. All the workers on the street stripping sweat. White collar hustlers are taking everything they can get. They put the nation on a hyperinflation track. No presidential administration can take it back. And now the taxpayers picking up the slack. Like they put a high dollar big brother monkey on your back. I want my bailout money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Justin Wolfers, a visiting professor at Princeton University and a professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He is the co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity, and he has an article at Freakonomics, The Secret Consensus Among Economists, and an article at Bloomberg with his wife, economist Betsy Stevenson, The U.S. Economic Policy Debate is a Sham. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Wolfers.
A pleasure to be here, Ian.
And why is it a sham? I mean, the study that's just come out by the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business apparently involves 40 of the country's leading economists across the political spectrum. So that's what we're talking about, the study that this independent group of economists has come up with.
Yeah, so the sham here is really the disjunction between modern economic thinking, and you can say a lot of things about economists. We get things wrong. We argue a lot. But there's also a whole lot of things we agree on. And there's an enormous disjunction between that and the current state of our economic policy debate in the United States. There's a huge range of issues where there's very violent public debates among folks running for re-election, whereas received wisdom or expert opinion, for what it's worth, seems to be fairly well united that, in a range of areas, that the bailout, for instance, was helped lower unemployment, that the stimulus helped lower unemployment, the worst of the nonsense we hear, things like Obama is responsible for high gas prices. It's a crazy idea. Gas prices are determined by supply and demand in global markets. It's that difference between the debate that's going on in Washington and what we economists think we've actually learned.
Well, one of the problems I think that obscures the debate is the problem that we have with the media in general, this binary notion of every argument has an equal and opposite argument, the pro-con and then the kind of meaningless mush. And for example, when the Republicans threatened the full faith and credit of the United States and threatened to shut down the government, that was basically covered as a he said, she said situation. So do you think that that's the problem here? That if you have, which I take it this study has revealed, is that most of the ignorance about economics is being propagated by the Republicans.
That's absolutely true. I mean, your example of the debt ceiling debate was really a splendid one. There's no economist in the entire United States who thinks that holding the full faith and credit of the federal government up for ransom is a good idea. It's going to hurt our credit rating in the longer run, and it looks like it may even have hurt the U.S. economy as it was happening. It really undermines people's confidence. And so there are these cases where there are views that are simply indefensible, maybe too hard, but there's certainly no defense coming from expert economists. And you're right, it's recorded as he said, she said. I think this is the first two laws of punditry. You know, the first one is for any idea that some idiot who's willing to sell his soul to get the spotlight. And the second law of punditry is that idiot will understand that he's likely to be better received if he calls himself an economist. But just because he says that on TV doesn't mean he's representing at all the vast rump of knowledge that, you know, there's dozens of us economists sitting there crunching numbers every day, going to conferences, studying the economy, trying to learn about the thing, and we have come to a firm consensus on a few things.
So Justin Wolfers, again, visiting professor at Princeton University and professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and the co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity. He has an article at Freakonomics, The Secret Consensus Among Economists, and an article at Bloomberg with his wife, economist Betsy Stevenson, the U.S. Economic Policy Debate. The study that you cite in both articles, the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, 92% of the economists across the board, across the political spectrum, agreed that the stimulus succeeded in reducing the jobless rate. And on the harder question of whether the benefit exceeded the cost, more than half thought it did. 1 in 3 was uncertain, and fewer than 1 in 6 disagreed. So don't you think, though, Justin, that a part of the problem here is that the Obama administration has not been particularly good at selling itself? It never sold its health plan in a way. They allowed the other side to tear that to shreds and to demonize it. And it seems to me that he really hasn't. I mean, I recall at the time they talked about shovel-ready jobs. That's not exactly an inspiring way to describe saving the American economy.
I mean, there's something to that. And, you know, I should say, of course, I'm certainly no gifted political scientist, so, you know, whether the Obama administration got this right or wrong, I think it's a judgment. It seems reasonable that, given that they were acting with the rough consensus of 92% of economists, as you say, it seems that they should have gotten a better reception from the broader American public. I think we economists also have to take some of the blame. The style of he said, she said reporting, where reporters were willing to simply repeat the nonsense they were hearing from one side of politics, is partly because we economists weren't disciplining the debate. I can imagine a well-meaning journalist out there who wants to try and inform his or her readers, but simply doesn't have access to or an easy way of understanding what it is that the mainstream of economic thinking currently says. I'm incredibly lucky. I have lunch with these people. I go to conferences with them. I hang out with them, and I know what that consensus is. But how do we make that accessible and a broader part of the public discussion so that it's not a public debate's not just people basically making up claims that have no foundation in serious analysis?
So the other canard that you cited, Justin Wolfers, after the big canard, which is that the stimulus did no good and all it did is add to the debt, which is a big Republican talking point. I guess it was Newt Gingrich that brought up the notion that Obama was somehow responsible for the rise of gas prices. My understanding from having spoken to the former head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and a number of people who analyze the gas, oil and gas market was that much of the price of gasoline was done through speculation and gaming the market. And I would have thought that that's a debate. I don't know why the Obama administration haven't engaged in it, but isn't there a debate to be had about the very nature of American capitalism, whether or not we are dominated by the financialization of the economy, at least not dominated, but it's up to 50% of the economy. And the questions that arise are that is an economy sustainable over the long term if it is run by those who are only interested in extracting wealth and not creating wealth except for themselves?
So, Ian, I think that's a spectacularly good example of the broader phenomenon, which is I certainly don't want to overstep my point. It's not that economists agree on everything. In fact, there are very good, deep, hard, serious problems that we disagree with each other vehemently about. You just raised one of those examples. There are some who believe that gas prices have been driven by speculators. There are others who think that it reflects more demand from China, or there are others who think it's supply disruptions in the Middle East. Sorting out which of those it is seems like a relatively important exercise. The claim, and so there are serious debates on almost all of these issues. There are serious debates. The problem is when in Washington, the debate we're having instead is Obama raised gas prices. And by the way, you know, I think that the Obama administration is not totally clean in this either. I don't think the balance of evidence supports the view that speculators are to blame for persistently high gas prices. And that's something that Obama has actually quietly assented to that story sort of getting out and about. But, you know, let's talk about the real issues, the ones you were just talking about, rather than these made-up lines that somehow seem to resonate when people are on the campaign trail.
Well, what about, though, the idea of having a national debate? And obviously the president would be the one that could stimulate it, and it may actually help get him re-elected, about what has happened to American capitalism with the growing financialization. Nobody, I think, is more of a poster boy for the 1% than Mitt Romney. So why not have a debate about, is it sustainable in the long term to have economics of extraction of wealth and concentration at the top, as opposed to what most of us remember or think about American capitalism from the days of the robber barons through the great arsenal of democracy in World War II, is that traditionally American capitalists have produced products and employed people, etc. So why not have a debate about the extraction versus the production model?
I think it's an absolutely excellent point. And further to your point, really, is this really is the historic moment for that. The public are, I think, open to having that debate. We've certainly seen over the past 3 years the real downsides from various forms of greed and avarice, sometimes outright corrupt behavior, interacting sometimes with bad regulation as well. And so I think people are open to that debate. I've been struck again, though, so think about things like financial reform. I think most Americans either think that in the wake of the Great Recession we definitely need it, or they find it intensely boring. But I am still struck when you go to Washington how controversial it is. And partly it's different voices have different weights in Washington. And the vast majority of your listeners right now, unfortunately, their voices are not particularly important. They're not important relative to corporations with very deep pockets. They're not important relative to those who have very sophisticated lobbying organizations. And, of course, they're not important relative to those who happen to live in swing states. And so thinking about whose voices are represented in the debate, I think if you want to have these deep and serious questions about the future of capitalism, you want to make sure that all voices are represented. And so there's some sense in which that debate is going to reflect the nature of our democracy. And so maybe you need to push the debate back one step further.
Well, but the fact that there is a consensus among economists across the political spectrum, that seems like a good place to start. So how do you economists get the word out that, time out, time for an adult conversation?
Yeah, I think, one answer would be I shouldn't overstate the extent of the consensus. The point of the articles I've written are there are cases where what's being said in Washington is just, frankly, complete nonsense. And I think there it's completely clear that it's outside the mainstream and we should howl down when people like Newt Gingrich say that gas prices are high because of Obama. We should howl that down as just being the worst form of misleading statement that you could make. There are harder questions. I don't think all economists, for instance, would agree that there's necessarily too much exploitation. Now, you know, I have my biases, you have your biases. That's a discussion that we can have. I think one of the ways in which we economists do have to plead guilty is we've done a particularly poor job at getting involved with the public debate, educating the public, letting them know what we, our perspectives are, also listening to the public, trying to understand what their concerns are and how we can best fit those into economic models. You know, the survey results you're talking about come from the survey at the University of Chicago, where they do ask leading economists, both left and right, about policy issues of the day. It sounds like an incredibly minor innovation, but by the same token, this one web page now exists where your listeners, my readers, other journalists can now go and find out what it is that the mainstream of economics thinks about certain issues. It's not going to resolve the issue for everyone. For instance, lots of people think the mainstream of economics is dead wrong. That's fine, as long as they understand that's the argument they're making.
Well, there is consensus. We've mentioned the 2 points so far. One, that the stimulus did, in fact, create jobs, and the economy would be infinitely worse had we not had stimulus. And two, that Obama is not responsible for the rise in the price of gasoline. The third one, I think, is very important, and that is that cutting taxes leads to higher government revenues. I mean, we have about the greatest disparity in wealth in the world at the moment, and it's growing. And not only is, the figures are extraordinary, that half of the people in this country only own 1% of the wealth. So isn't the evidence pretty manifest that so far cutting taxes for the wealthy has just made the wealthy wealthier?
So this one really infuriates me. There was a claim that was made decades ago that if you cut taxes, that would cause people to do so much more work that the tax cut would pay for itself. And maybe when we're in an era when tax rates were as high as 91%, that may have made sense then. But today, you literally cannot find an economist who thinks that's a reasonable view of the world. Yet in the Republican debates, we had candidate after candidate standing up and saying, I'm just going to cut taxes, that'll grow the economy, I don't need to talk about how I'm going to balance the budget. Right now, we have Mitt Romney who's promised us all he's going to balance the budget, and that we all get a 20% tax cut. How we do both of those things at the same time is never quite spelled out. And I guess he's just hoping the magic of supply-side economics is going to take care of all of that for him. So this is a very standard Republican talking point, but it's one that literally has no empirical foundation. And so it's one that we should all, your listeners, my readers, fellow journalists, should call people out on. It's simply not an acceptable form of argument because there's nothing to support it. There are milder forms so there's enormous consensus there, but then there are things economists still disagree about. So would cutting taxes for the rich grow the economy? Some economists say yes, some economists say no. There's a real and important debate to be had there. There's a different debate again as well, which is if we're going to cut taxes for a group, which group would do a better job of growing the economy? And there's a presumption that I don't quite understand where it comes from the Republicans, that if you want to create jobs, what you have to do is cut taxes for the rich. That's essentially them saying, if you're not rich, you have no ability to create jobs, which I think is tremendously insulting to your carpenter, to your plumber, to my hairdresser, and so on. And so that, again, is another different but important and serious debate we can have, which is if we want to create jobs, who is it we need to be targeting those tax breaks to?
But if you talk to an actual businessman, Justin Wolfers, you find that they say that's a nonsensical argument too, that they're paying taxes has nothing to do with whether their customers can afford to buy their product. And only when their customers have money in their pocket and there is demand do they hire people. They don't hire people for altruistic reasons. They hire people when they have to hire people.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think most economists would urge you to draw a distinction between the short run and the long run. So in the short run, right now, we're in a recession, and most employers I talk to right now, I agree with you, say the reason I'm not hiring more people is because people don't want to buy the stuff that they would make. over the longer run, hopefully the economy is going to return to full employment. And so then the question is, would cutting taxes for a business make it more profitable for them to expand production? That would, and given that businesses like profits, it seems reasonable to believe that over the medium or longer run, tax cuts for some groups would lead them to do more of some activity. I don't want to argue about whether it does or doesn't occur. I think the deeper, harder, and more important question is, are those effects big or small? If they're really big, then that says it's important to have a tax-cutting agenda. And if they're really small, it says it's really important. The tax cuts aren't that valuable, and the stuff we use taxes for, paying down the deficit or creating a social safety net or education, maybe we should do more of it so that we can do more of those things.
Well, just in closing, Justin Wolfers, you mentioned earlier that holding the full faith and credit of the United States ransom, as the Republicans did in the budget standoff, that damaged the U.S. economy. And in your article at Freakonomics, you also say that continued inaction will lead the U.S. to walk off the fiscal cliff, which may already be dragging the economy down. There is, I think, isn't there a silver lining in the fiscal cliff in as much as they've already agreed to the sequester deal, and they're trying to wiggle their way out of that? But those kind of across-the-board cuts to defense and other parts of the economy, probably about the only thing that's going to work, isn't it? Because, you know, obviously the military-industrial complex and their supporters in Washington are trying to undo that deal.
I think there's two ways of thinking about the issues coming up. One is you could think about it through the lens of ideology. You know, so if you're on the left, you want bigger cuts to defense, and if you're on the right, you probably want bigger cuts to social safety programs. But I think the thing that worries me about the fiscal cliff is not the left versus right thing. It's actually the purely macroeconomic thing, which is at the end of the year, if Congress does nothing, taxes are going to go up and some government spending programs will be cut. And this will all occur at a point when the economy is incredibly weak. So all of those things, by the way, would be good if all you cared about was getting rid of the deficit. But I think of getting rid of the deficit as being a really important 10-15-year project. The big project, the most important, the most pressing economic concern the U.S. has today is 8% unemployment and getting people back to work. And the threat that taxes will rise and government spending will fall could well be enough to push the U.S. into recession at a time when people, millions of people already have jobs. And that's the thing I really fear. It may be we never walk off the fiscal cliff and Congress actually gets something done. But even then, I don't think that lets them off the hook. Because right now, they could do something right now. They're not. So if you think about how much you're going to spend next week, or if you're a business, whether you're going to invest next week, you're thinking, well, you know, there's some risk the U.S. economy will turn south because of congressional inaction. And that may already be retarding spending right now, which may be hurting the economy right now. And the last time that this game was played, the budget slowdown, the budget standoff a year and a bit ago, it actually had a huge effect on consumer confidence. You could see at the moment John Boehner said, I'm going to hold the full faith and credit of the United States ransom. Consumer confidence plummeted immediately. The other thing we saw at the time was the economic recovery had been starting to accelerate, and in fact it then stalled shortly thereafter. So it does seem like Congress, again, it's not just holding full faith and credit of the United States for ransom, they're also actually holding the economic recovery somewhat to ransom, and I honestly can't see any rationale, any economic rationale for doing that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Justin Wolfers.
Pleasure, Ian. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Justin Wolfers, who's a visiting professor at Princeton University and a professor in the Business and Public Policy Department at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. He's the co-editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity, and he has an article at Freakonomics, The Secret Consensus Among Economists, and an article at Bloomberg with his wife, economist Betsy Stevenson, The U.S. Economic Policy Debate is a Sham. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how drought will be the new normal in the American West.
Stocks go up, but the jobs disappear.
Mom
number, economy, make me understand all the numbers. Why daddy's on a welfare plan, turning 30, 40, 50, gotta move in with my parents, and the stocks go up, but the jobs disappear.
I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is writer and conservationist William DeBuise, who's the author of seven books, which range from memoir and biography to environmental history and studies of place. In 2000, he earned the National Range Management Award of the U.S. Forest Service, and from 2001 to 2004, under an appointment by President Bill Clinton, he served as the founding chairman of the Valle Caldera Trust, which administers the 89,000-acre Valle Caldera National Preserve. His books include Enchantment and Exploitation, The Life and Hard Times of a New Mexico Mountain Range, The Walk, and most recently, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. He has an article at Tom Dispatch, The Oxygen Planet Struts Its Stuff, Not a Perfect Storm, but the New Norm in the American West. Welcome to Background Briefing, William DeBuise.
Thank you. It's very good to be with you.
And I've been covering, of course, the drought in the American breadbasket, the ice sheet melting in Greenland, and the Great Rift in the Antarctica. And now you're filling in more of the picture, which, of course, indicates global warming is alive and well, even though there's a lot of denial in this country. Give us a sense, though, of, since I'm talking to you from California and you're in New Mexico, what can we expect in the Southwest in the next couple of decades? What's it going to look like?
Well, you're quite right that there are a lot of dots out there, and gradually people are connecting them more and more from the Arctic to the temperate area here. In the Southwest and the Rocky Mountains, what we can expect is more aridity. As temperatures rise, things necessarily dry out more. Higher temperatures mean more evaporation. More evaporation means more aridity. And that's even if precipitation stays the same, but don't bet your house on it. All in all, it means for more vulnerability to fire, insects, and heat-induced death for forests throughout the southern Rocky Mountains, and a great deal of strain and stress and agriculture and many other sectors of human activity.
Well, quite a big part of the Southwest, particularly Arizona's big cities, and of course, the poster boy for an unnatural city, if you will, is Las Vegas, Nevada. Isn't that inherently a problem, that we've built cities and transported water a long distance to keep these artificial cities alive?
Well, that's exactly right. Edward Abbey, the writer, pointed out that the Southwest has plenty of water. We just put our cities in the wrong places.
So are these cities expendable then?
Well, they're not. Nothing's expendable. I mean, wherever people have put their hearts, wherever they've built their dreams, become very important places to society. Unfortunately, our big conurbations in the Southwest are increasingly vulnerable to water shocks of one kind or another, and it's because of that, for instance, that the Southern Nevada Water Authority is presently building what amounts to a bathtub drain in the very bottom of Lake Mead. Nevada is making every move it can to assure water security for the future, but in an era of climate change, we can expect our rivers to decline in volume by quite considerable amounts. Some projections say about 20% by mid-century. And that's a lot of water to be missing
in a region of the country that's already oversubscribed, overtaxed, and overallocated.
So, again, I'm speaking with William DeBuys, who's the author of seven books, which range from memoir and biography to environmental history and studies of place. He's a writer and a conservationist, and his latest book is A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. He has an article at Tom Dispatch, The Oxygen Planet Struts Its Stuff, Not a Perfect Storm, but the New Norm in the American West. So describe further, if you will, the new norm in the American West with increased aridity.
Well, we're going to have wet periods and dry periods, as we have had in the past. But these wet and dry cyclical changes, basically produced by El Nino and La Nina, everybody's heard about them, these wet and dry periods are going to be superimposed on a much drier and much hotter climatic norm. The climatologists predict, for instance, that the droughts of the 1930s and the 1950s, those conditions are going to be the new normal in the future of the American Southwest. And so we'll have droughts and wet periods superimposed on that. You know, drought is an exceptional event. We don't say that the Sahara Desert is experiencing drought. The Sahara Desert is dry by nature. In the American Southwest, we are getting drier and drier by nature as a result of climate change.
Well, we've already witnessed record fires in Texas, in Colorado, and in New Mexico, and in Arizona, and, of course, in California as well. And then you're suggesting in your article at Tom Dispatch in the Huffington Post, The Oxygen Planet Struts Its Stuff, Not a Perfect Storm, But the New Norm in the American West, that a lethal combination of drought, insect plagues, windstorms, and legions of dead, dying, and stressed-out trees constitute what some pundits are calling wildfires' perfect storm. So it sounds like this is self-reinforcing. The drier it gets, the more likely a spark will set off, and there's more tinder for forest fires.
Well, that's exactly right. And part of our vulnerability to catastrophic fire is human-produced. Fire suppression over the last century and a quarter has greatly contributed to the buildup of fuels in the forest. But ultimately, the heating of the environment is going to cancel out that signal of human fuel building, and we're going to have so much heat stress on our trees, on our forest communities, that our vulnerability to these catastrophic fires will become, in a sense, normal. We may not even continue to look at them as catastrophic, but just part of the normal state of affairs.
Well, but if, you know, you're somebody that's been preserving an 89,000-acre national preserve, the Valle Caldera Trust, or the Valle Caldera National Preserve, what happens when that's gone? I mean, in other words, if this is going to be an escalating condition, it's going to look pretty bad in a few decades, the entire Southwest, isn't it?
Well, in one respect, you could look at it as a situation in which heartbreak becomes normal. You know, we all care a lot about the woods, about the forests, and people get attached to places quite rightly and quite naturally. And a lot of the places to which we are attached are changing dramatically under the pressure of a warming and drying climate. We've already seen 5 million acres of lodgepole pine in Colorado, some of the most beautiful scenery in western North America, succumb to bark beetles, and those bark beetles are part of the package of climate change. They're a natural force in the environment, but with warmer winters, more of them survive to the spring. With warmer summers, more of them, with the summer being longer, from frost to frost, there are more generations of insect reproduction. So we get more swarms, more impact on the trees, more heat stress. In the drought in Texas and Oklahoma last summer, between 2 and 10% of all the trees in Texas died. So these are heartbreakingly gigantic changes in the landscape, in the environment. And I suppose, reluctantly, we're all going to have to get used to seeing a lot of our favorite places be transformed, and not for the better.
Unless, of course, we wake up to the reality of global warming and start to do something about it. And what do you think the chances of that are?
Well, you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation some of the other news that we've been hearing, from the melting in Greenland to changes in Antarctica, record high temperatures all across the United States. It makes you wonder just how many dots we have to connect before people and the politicians wake up to the enormity of what we're facing here. I think that with additional disasters, sadly enough, the point of all this will finally be driven home to people. My big concern is that when that time comes, I'm not entirely sure we're going to react rationally. It would be a tragedy compounded on other tragedies if, instead of reacting in a science-based, rational way, we fled to even more magical thinking. It's going to be a hard set of decisions to make to work our way through this problem, and we're going to have to use every resource at our disposal to make the right ones.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, William DeBuys.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with the writer and conservationist William DeBuys. He's the author of 7 books, which range from memoir and biography to environmental history and studies of place. In 2000, he earned the National Range Management Award of the United States Forest Service, and from 2001 to 2004 was appointed by President Bill Clinton to serve as the founding chairman of the Valle Caldera Trust, which administers the 89,000-acre Valle Caldera National Preserve. He's the author of a number of books, including The Enchantment and Exploitation, The Life and Hard Times of a New Mexico Mountain Range, The Walk, and most recently, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. He has an article at the Huffington Post and Tom Dispatch, The Oxygen Planet Struts Its Stuff, Not a Perfect Storm, but the New Norm in the American West. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Fahen Mohammed. And this program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.